There are moments in my life when I feel as if I am profoundly misunderstood. Moments in which I hope that those who listen to this podcast might prick up their ears like an engineer, or perhaps spend like a soccer mom during the Christmas season, fornicate like a virago, or in the case of this week's guest, read like a writer. Sometimes it pays to think from an expert's perspective. After all, they sometimes know what they're talking about, even when they don't. I'm feeling particularly introspective right now because there was once an evening in my life in which my expertise was set to be unleashed upon this nation at large, with considerable avarice attached. People told me that they were my friends. I believed them and was led to the reprobate status I currently inhabit. And now I face another Christmas alone at the Motel 6, which isn't as bad as you might think. I do, after all, have an ex-wife who might take pity upon me, particularly if I arrive with an alimony check. If only the judge realized that the radio business is as tough to negotiate through as beef bristle.
So I am here with Franzine Prose, author of A Changed Man, and most recently a nonfiction book called Reading Like a Writer. Franzine, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
First off, I wanted to actually, ask you, because some people approach reading from a sort of escapist position, I'd like to put forth the question to you, why should a reader read like a writer?
Well, for one thing, if they might want to be a writer, it would certainly be very helpful. I mean, I think I've always thought it's the best way of learning how to write is to actually go to great literature. But also, the way that people call into Car Talk to find out how these guys approach fixing a car engine. I mean, there is a different way that writer reads. We read, I think, more appreciatively and with a certain kind of admiration. And also, for the nerve of another writer who has the just galls to pull something off that we could never have imagined doing.
I guess what I'm wondering is, because I've had this conversation, because I'm a literary person, if you're a literary person, with people who like read books to escape, and so I'm wondering how, if you have any ideas as to how to sort of bridge the divide here or get people to understand, you champion, for example, intricate sort of sentence analysis and the like. So what is the appeal to sort of, I guess, the lay reader who doesn't want to be a writer?
Well, there's a lot to be said for reading books for escape as well. I mean, when I'm on an airplane, I just as soon read something that's so engrossing that it takes me away from the fact that that's what I'm doing. Or, when people have hard times in their lives and they just want to be out of there, there's certain books that'll do that. But then there's certain books that you read and you just get into the plot and the characters and you read all the way through. And then there's something about how beautifully they're written, say, or how marvelously they capture a character, or that makes you want to go back and actually examine how the writer did that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should also point out that there's a section where you mentioned that you were reading People magazine in preparation for Chekhov, which is the reward at the end.
Right, so that's right.
Just to be clear on this.
And I was reading People magazine because I was in this terrifying bus station, and I was afraid, as I say, to lose contact with my surroundings for any longer than it took to read a People magazine.
One of the big points that you push for in this book, again, is the careful analysis of sentences. Now, I looked at your books to be read immediately, and I noticed that you didn't recommend just the elements of style, but the illustrated elements of style. Now, this to me was interesting because it was suggesting to me, like, oh, well, grammar and figuring out independent clauses and figuring out what works, this should be fun. So I wanted to actually ask you, well, how do we make this really technical kind of sentence breaking down and all that really sort of fun for people?
Well, I still remember when we were taught to diagram sentences in school, and that was a lot of fun. And actually, I quote in the book Gertrude Stein saying that diagramming sentences was still her favorite activity ever. So, and I don't know if that's taught anymore, but it certainly should be, because it turned it into a kind of puzzle. And at the reward for doing the puzzle was a greater understanding of what made a sentence clear and easy to understand.
Well, I mean, but specifically, though, what could we do to make it fun? Because a lot of people, I think, a lot of kids in particular, will probably view this, oh, I have to go ahead and find out the subject verb. And, the illustrated sort of thing kind of suggested to me that, and there's a spirit in your book, I think, of fun. You don't really browbeat the reader, I feel.
Let's hope not.
Yeah.
Well, there is an end run around it, which I think is, if you get kids who are reading constantly and reading voraciously, they don't have to be taught grammar in quite the same way. I mean, that is, you do pick up a certain amount by osmosis. So I think kids have a certain instinctive idea of what makes a clear, good sentence if they're reading all the time. Mm-hmm. There's still certain elements of grammar, and maybe it's not going to be fun. Maybe that's not necessary. I mean, certain things, like, for example, I never found arithmetic to be particularly fun, but I had to at least learn the rudiments of addition and subtraction and some multiplication and division. So it might not be, you know, it might not be possible to make it completely enjoyable, but that doesn't make it any less necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the same time, we're dealing also with an environment, particularly like, you know, in academia, where you're dealing with a lot of post-structuralists who want to look at novels and books and fiction in a sort of feminist or social issue kind of setting. You know, laying down the gauntlet here like this is, you know, which of course you satirized in Blue Angel to some degree. But I wanted to sort of ask, we have this book, among many other books. Mm-hmm. What do we do to sort of, you know, have this kind of return to sort of language or syntax as a sort of priority?
Well, people keep telling me that all those vogues for structuralism and post-structuralism and deconstructionism are passing, which couldn't make me happier. I mean, and you know, I think that those things have had a very bad effect, not only on reading, but on writing. I mean, that is because they encourage people to use jargon. They encourage students to use jargon. I mean, when I teach, one of the assignments that I give is to ask my students to find a passage of jargon, academic jargon, literary jargon, art history jargon, and then translate it back into English and bring both passages into class. And often the jargon that they come up with is theory jargon, literary theory jargon. So, nothing could make me happier than to hear that that's on its way out.
But at the same time, you're also dealing with the situation. On the flip side, you have all of these grad students who are entering grad school,
right,
and then they're being totally hardwired to think exclusively upon these lines while the drink gets set down.
Thank you.
To actually go ahead and get them to sort of unlearn, so to speak, this thing that they're actually encouraged and taught to do. I mean, you know, what is there really a solution? Because these people then go on to teach, you know?
Well, it's painful for them to unlearn it. And also, because it is academia, they're being trained in a certain way to then, you know, it is a kind of professional school. So they're being taught the language of the profession. And again, I can only hope that's on its way out. But I had an experience with a young writer, a young critic, who'd gone to Brown and, you know, a very sort of heavily theory-laden education, and was writing a film review and had written it in a way that couldn't be understood. And his mom, as a friend of mine, said, you know, just help him. So he came over, and he's this wonderful, brilliant kid. And we just went through his review and line by line, and I said, just tell me in English what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
And we did the same thing, which was translated back into English.
Yeah, well, interesting. So really it boils down to like getting people to learn line editing.
That's right, line editing. Yeah, line editing and clarity. Again, you know, and also the idea that you're writing for someone whom you want to understand what you're writing rather than for someone who you want to be mystified and confused by what you've written.
You know, often in like UK newspapers I read, you know, complaints from the UK because American novels tend to be big, bloated, compared to the UK counterparts, which are often 300 pages, whereas our generally like 500 pages. Do you think that the word processor is in some way responsible for this kind of bloat, or...?
I guess. Well, in the old days when we had to type out entire drafts, it certainly made you economical. Mm-hmm. I mean, if each time you were revising, you had to sit down and type out 300 pages, there was a great temptation to make the next draft 250 pages. But I don't understand it because I still have that desire to make things as concise and economical as possible, and I think many writers do. I mean, some don't, obviously, but also I don't feel the compulsion to write the 500-page novel for the sake of writing the 500-page novel.
Well, some people can't stop themselves. I remember David Foster Wallace said for Infinite Jest that he could not stop writing, which is why it ended up being this really large book.
You know? There you go.
You suggest in this book that writers should use one-line paragraphs sparingly. And I actually wanted to ask you about this. Specifically, you observed this is a lazy writer's attempt to compel us to pay attention or to inject energy and life into a narrative of falsely inflating the importance of sentences that our eyes or our eye might skip over entirely if they were more placed more quietly and modestly inside a longer paragraph. Now, I actually want to put a poser to you. What of a novelist like, say, David Markson or Carol Mazo, who really sort of use one line sort of sentences to for cultural consciousness in one on one hand, mm-hmm. and for Maisel's case, sort of like, you know, kind of individual thought process. Is there, you know, you compare, you have a friend compare a one-line paragraph to basically getting punched, but doesn't fiction sometimes need to punch? Doesn't sometimes need to grab people by the lapels? Or
yeah, well, but I think I go on to take examples from a Ray Carver story of one-line paragraphs that are just genius use of a form. I mean, you know, I would hate to go on record as saying don't do this or don't do that, because the whole book for me is kind of, you know, working against the idea of telling people not to do anything or that there's any rule or anything that's forbidden. I mean, want to use a one-line paragraph, God bless you, but it better be a good one-line paragraph, like a Ray Carver one-line paragraph.
Yeah. But what about experimentalism, like Marxian or Kazin?
Well, you know, there's a great William Trevor Paris review interview in which he says basically all writing is experimental writing, but the experiments are hidden. And I think that's true. I mean, I always, you know, I often have problems with the idea of experimental writing because, you know, Ben Marcus is another example of, you know, a marvelous writer who I think is often called experimental or maybe even calls himself experimental. But to me, it's no different from reading any other kind of fiction. Or Lydia Davis.
Yeah.
You know, fiction is fiction, and you know, they're different forms, but essentially, they're all dealing with language. They're all dealing, or almost all dealing with character, with different kinds of narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and of course, Ben Markson wrote that Harper's essay mm-hmm. as well. But I guess, though, you know, and again, that is a good point, but we're, I guess, talking about, I think, more reader reception, because mm-hmm. I talked with Mark Danielewski, and he said he insisted he wasn't an experimental writer, and yet he has this really batty book that you have to turn both ways around.
No, know? I don't think anyone thinks of himself or herself as an experimental writer, really. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, writers are writers, really.
What would be the criteria, then, for a acceptable one-line paragraph for you?
It should be so compressed and so communicative and so, I mean, you would read it and not think of wanting to add another line to the paragraph. I mean, it would just seem a perfect example of that form. And again, I mean, I always have to work from the example to the general, you know, so those one-line paragraphs from Ray Carver just seem masterful to me. So, you know, no sooner did I say don't write one-line paragraphs than I find these Ray Carver paragraphs, which are extraordinary.
Really, then, I guess, because you also rail against the show-don't-tell rule in this book, and really, I guess, it seems to me, based off of reading this, that it was more of a sort of polemic book against these absolute values that we're told to...
Exactly, exactly. You know, all these rules. I mean, when I teach, one of the criteria I use to pick a reading list is that I want to choose books that break all those rules that students are being taught in their workshops.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why do you think, though, I mean, absolutes have to be in some sense. I mean, there's the old sort of saying that you should learn the rules and then know how to break them, taught in almost every sort of writing class. I mean, where do rules apply and where do they not apply? I mean,
well, you know, Jackson Pollock never did learn how to draw.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a terrible draftsman. And then, so apparently, he didn't have to learn the basics. And I mean, he did copy Renaissance paintings, it's true, but not very well. I don't know, really. I mean, I just think that every work kind of makes its own rules or defies the rules. Or, you know, I mean, I think that those rules evolve, frankly, in response to the fact that it's very hard to tell the truth in workshops for very good reason. I mean, you know, it's such a crazy idea that you have the writer sitting there in the room and that you critique the writer's work with a bunch of near strangers with the person actually sitting there, you know, suffering. So consequently, all these euphemisms have evolved around the things that you're not allowed to say. For example, you're not allowed to say that something is boring. I mean, that's, you know, the B word. It can't be said in the writing class. So I think that the show don't tell rule has evolved as a response to the inability to say, you know, it just bored the heck out of me. So instead you say, well, maybe it would be better if you dramatized it more, you know, but that's just ridiculous.
But at the same time, there's also, well, you point, for example, to Richard Yates's Revolutionary Road, which is like basically laced with telling details. And actually, I was curious why you didn't actually mention Sherlock Holmes. I mean, you mentioned Nero Wolfe, but Sherlock Holmes is like this great example of I guess, observational details that essentially reveal all, which of course allow Holmes to solve for the cases.
Right. God, I wish I had.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, you know, once you read a book, then you realize what you should have said.
Yeah.
And that certainly would have been great.
Did you have, since a lot of this book is composed of, like, excerpts, did you have difficulties securing rights for a lot of these passages?
Well, no, because, you know, the rule for what you have to actually pay for is 300, under 300 words you're allowed to quote freely. So in many cases I was very conscious of staying under 300 words, yeah. And then I could just use it.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me, of course, you know, the Nabokov estate is notoriously difficult,
yeah.
You know, so I pay them quite a bit of money. But it would seem to me that that writers would want their work quoted in something like this, and you know, in the chance that it would make readers discover their work, and more readers would go and actually buy their books.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I wanted also put forth to you, going back to this notion of like approaching writing and approaching reading with care. Anthony Burgess once noted very famously that a novel should be written with some sense of urgency, and while you champion subtext, isn't there a point where the writer has to sort of let go of laboring and ticking around with something? I mean, does this destroy the spontaneity of writing at some point?
Or? Well, eventually it starts turning to gibberish. I mean, I think that's the way you know that something's done. You know, you're fiddling, you're taking out commas, putting in commas, and suddenly you realize you're making it a million times worse, you can't understand what you've written, you're adding the wrong word, and, you know, then it really is time to let it go. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's that great passage that I quote part of from Isaac Babel, in which he talks about the rules of revision. And you know, he says everything has to be rewritten and on. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And then he says, but the most important thing is not to mess up your work by working on it too long. So it's a very fine balance between getting it right and ruining it.
I know that, for example, Blue Angel and A Changed Man each took 5 years. What would be the balance for you as a writer, just to help us out here?
Well, you know, the very last sets of revisions I do, I just open the manuscript at random, because the thing is, it's what's dangerous is that you start reading your own work and you get sucked up in the plot and the characters and you read it, you know, God forbid, like an actual reader might be reading somebody else's work. But if you open it at random so that you have no idea what came before or after, and you're just looking at what's actually on the page sentence by sentence, it makes it easier to revise or to cut because it's just words, you know. You've lost the momentum of a reader, and you're just looking at what's there on that particular page, and, you know, you can change it.
Well, it's also, you know, this goes back to the recent book here, and that is the notion of having, again, unwire, even... Every reader, essentially, I would argue, possibly reads for narrative first, language second. I don't know, I mean, how you offer very sort of clear examples and new ways of sort of, you know, or reminding us of of existing sort of procedures. But I'm wondering, though, again, going back to this question of the lay reader, do you... I mean, reading slow, some people read fast, some people read slow, some people read for book clubs, some people read to just escape. I mean, there has to be...
You know, basically, I'm happy if anybody's reading at all. I mean, that really, you know, I'm a writer. I'm thrilled when I hear someone's read a book, period. I'm just delighted because, you know, writers are always being told that book culture is dying and no one's reading books anymore and they're just playing video games and watching TV and so on. So that thrills me. But on the other hand, I mean, if you want to make the distinction between, you know, certain kinds of writing, I'm always surprised when I try to read certain, let's say, best-selling mysteries. I mean, I do read mysteries. You know, I read mysteries on airplanes. But there's certain best-selling mysteries that I read, and apparently people find them fascinating. Lots of people find them, you know, millions of people find them. And I find myself unbelievably bored. And I think I'm bored partly because the language is so boring. So that for me goes beyond the question of whodunit. I mean, if I can't stand to read it page by page because it's so full of cliches and da 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 da, it doesn't matter who's going to solve the mystery and how.
But interestingly, literary wise, there seems to be a proclivity for sort of, I guess, toy box novels in the sense of puzzle novels or novels that are, again, going back to this notion of big, momentous, the sort of offshoots of postmodernism.
Uh-huh. What are you talking, like what?
Well, like something like, I guess, like, for example, we've got a new Pynchon book coming out, Against the Day, you know, which I look forward to reading, but that's like a 1,100 word investment, and it'll be layered upon layered upon layered with stuff, making even a slow reader read at the snail's pace.
I love Gravity's Rainbow. Yeah. I really love Gravity's Rainbow. And a friend gave me great advice, which I think I quote in the book, which is, you know, maybe you'll lose the thread of the plot for 200 pages. Maybe you'll just lose it. But don't worry, you'll pick it up again and just keep reading. And on the other hand, the only way I read Mason Dixon, partly because I was interested, and then I had to be on a panel on Mason, and I would have put it down, frankly. But I was going to be on this panel, and then I was on a train going from Washington to New York that was sidelined for 3 hours, and the only book I had was Mason Dixon. And I read it, so I finished it. But I don't know if I would have finished it without that.
So it seems that, you know, the slow reading aspect also applies possibly to you, but or was this a sort of a thing where you're kind of reading something that doesn't necessarily sparkle to you in the way that the Chekhov does?
I've learned not to finish books. Yeah. I mean, and I always tell people, you don't have to finish it if you don't like it. You know, there's no, I mean, there. I always feel sort of sad when people say talk about the compulsion to finish a book, because there, in fact, there's so many books out there that why force yourself to read something that bores you or you don't like when you can just find something else that you do like?
Okay. I guess what I was suggesting, to sort of rephrase my question, is that in an environment that does not necessarily favor Chekhov as the sort of literary taste, that often favors like the Pestle book or another volume of David Foster Wallace essays, or things that are very informational based as opposed to syntactical, or I mean, these books, which is not to argue that these aren't syntactical, but what I mean to say is like behavioral, I guess, Chekhovian sorts of subtext.
Right.
Well,
you know, there's just different tastes. I mean, I tried very hard to read the Pestle book and didn't get very far in it. On the other hand, I thought Jennifer Egan's book, The Keep, was marvelous. I mean, I just couldn't put it down, and I was filled with admiration for how strange and interesting it was. So you know, there are people that like Janet Ivanovich, and there are people that like David Foster Wallace, and there are people that like Chekhov, and you know, it's a big world, and there are all different kinds of readers in it.
Yeah. But I guess, though, do you see possibly in like the up-and-coming sort of authors any potential sort of Chekhovian sort of thing that, you know, something you could point to and say, yes, this is it? I mean, I know, for example, one of the younger writers you sort of point to is Bruce Wagner, for example. But
yeah, I'm a big Bruce Wagner fan, and boy, is he not Chekhovian.
Yeah.
He's the least Chekhovian guy arena. I mean, he's just this enraged, you know, it's like basically having someone spit on you for 400 pages, but I love the energy of it. I mean, I just love the rage. On the other hand, let's say David Besmozgus is an extremely Chekhovian writer. I mean, the humanity and the compassion and the feeling for character. Or Z.Z. Packer, who writes in that sort of old, I suppose you could say, old-fashioned Chekhovian traditional way. So, you know, I mean, I think in every generation, especially more recently, there are writers that might fall into every one of those categories.
Now, I actually wanted to talk with you about the dialogue section of the book. I wanted to actually point William Gaddis's J.R., which is a book that is almost devoid of anything but dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much nothing but that. And I bring this up because you sort of, this also ties into the gesture section, where you sort of suggest that it's one of those elements that you can sort of take it or leave it. I'm wondering if gestures, is this something that is sort of, you know, really necessary to provide the reader with more context, or is it just a matter of kind of delving deep into a sort of book along these lines like J.R.?
Well, speaking of reading like a writer, I mean, I remember it even before I became a writer, reading The Recognitions as a kid. And there's that long party scene, you know, for like hundreds of pages, right, a party scene. And there's almost no dialogue attribution. I mean, people are just talking. And he's done such a marvelous job of creating characters that you know who's talking even without dialogue attribution. And as I said, even before I was a writer or thought of myself as a writer, I thought, oh my God, I can't believe he did this. You know, how virtuosic to be able to do that. So So, you know, I mean, there are certain writers who do things extraordinarily well, and they don't need any of the things that I say they might need in the book. Gesture, if you're William Geddes, who needs it?
Yeah, okay. So, again, it goes against these absolutes.
Right,
well,
right.
Well, but I want to talk about, I'm going to bring up actually an interesting example, and that is James M. Cain. He wrote actually a very interesting book called Past All Dishonor, which was a Civil War novel. I'm not sure if you knew this.
I had no idea.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing. He wrote this book, and he really meticulously went to all these libraries, read depositions, read testimony, read everything he could to sort of get the speech right.
Mm-hmm.
And basically his critics accused him at the time of, like, because it ended up being sort of like tough guy prose. And what's interesting is that Cain sort of said, well, look, I did all this research, this is what I found, and this is what I reproduced. So this brings up the point you raise in your book, which is that, you know, and the James Wood, the example that you mentioned, where he essentially sort of says that, you know, sometimes these invented terms feel as if they are of the time. I wanted to put the question to you. Do you think, given the James Wood scenario and the James Cain scenario, I'm bringing a lot of James here, James is here, is it possible for dialogue to truly sort of represent a time, or is it one of these things where it's just this kind of, the novel is sort of a prism more than anything else?
It's an interesting question. I mean, then the related question is, why, when you read Jane Austen, don't you feel that people are speaking in some old-fashioned mannered, stilted? I mean, it sounds like naturalistic dialogue. You know, I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, you read Chaucer, and it doesn't sound for a moment like modern. You know, it's not actually in modern English. I don't know. I mean, Cain. You know, Cain writes great dialogue in the novels I have read. So. What's it called?
It's called Past All Dishonor. I'll write it down.
Okay, great.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, you know, is it even possible for a novel to both convey the sense of subtext as well as be truly sort of representative of vernacular during a given time? Or?
Well, I think that no matter what dialect people are speaking in, I mean, no matter, let's say they are tough guys, right? Let's say they're like flat out tough guys. Nonetheless, when they speak, they're doing the same thing everybody else is doing, which is saying something, not saying something, speaking differently depending on whom they're speaking to, listening differently depending on who's speaking. So why should they be different from any other human beings, even though they're big tough guys or anything, or children, or, you know, college teachers? Or, I mean, in that sense, I think people are the same. That is human speech, and regardless of the inflection, there's certain things that are going on underneath speech that's going on in every conversation.
Yeah. But at the same time, we're talking about subtext versus, I guess, reproduction. I mean, I'm not, you know, you point out the example of, like, I mean, it's like you pointed out that you have your students often go into a place and sort of transcribe dialogue. And while there's certainly interesting things there, there's a funny little difference between, like, a transcript and then trying to sort of get a narrative proceeding, because people tend to ramble. Or is there, do you feel that there's a crossover here?
Well, you know, one of the things I say is that the transcript is often so much better than the dialogue they're writing.
Yeah.
You know, people are interesting. When you listen to people, you hear them tell stories, you hear them say things they don't mean to say. I mean, there's something always instructive if you actually pay attention to what people are saying.
I wanted to actually point to the fact that you break up much of the discussion of this book to sentences and paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering why you didn't dwell on either chapters or blocks of text, because this seems to me just as important in terms of, like, you know, how a novel is laid out or how a piece of fiction is laid out. I mean, you know, if you flip a page and there's, like, three paragraphs, or if you flip a page and there's, like, 25 paragraphs, they're totally different. I'm wondering, maybe you had some thoughts on the actual...
Once again, I wish I'd done that. I mean, you know, again, if I had to do more reading like a writer or rereading like a writer, I would do a whole chapter on the space break.
Yeah.
You know, this is the way that the space break functions. Often, you know, a writer thinks that he or she has to write an entire scene, and then it turns out you just put a space break in and you don't have to. It takes place during the space break, and the reader understands perfectly well.
Okay.
So, you know, and what happens in a chapter? I mean, again, you know, you analyze a book, you look at a chapter, you see how much time passes, you know, how many characters are in the chapter. I think you can learn from all those things.
Okay, fair enough. We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one more question that was about detail.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a thing as too much detail? I present, for example, Nicholson Baker's The Mezzanine, which is a fascinating book that either people love or hate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it presents through this context of describing staplers and describing toilet stalls a sort of form of consciousness. I hate to pressure you into a question of absolutes, but for example, how does something like this sort of function within the ideas you present in this book?
Well, it should be, the details should be revealing, necessary, and interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's obsessive, it's like any other obsession. Sometimes it's interesting, sometimes it's not. But, you know, the example I always use of the pointless detail is the example of, you know, he walked into a room lined with gray metal bookcases. There were little holes in the middle of the gray metal bars. You know, everybody knows what gray metal cases, you know, bookcases look like, so why would you even bother to do that? You know, and there are any number of details that just, you know, they're meant to authenticate, and actually they just distract and bore. So.
And some people argue that of Nicholson Baker's The Mezzanine.
Some people
But at the same time, it's also a really kind of, I would argue, it's very interesting to sort of glimpse inside all this detail to see exactly how the world is laid out, and to sort of see how, like, there are all these things around us, this glass, this microphone, that has all these minuscule details that we sort of take for granted. So you run a big risk here.
But, you know, if you're writing an obsessive character,
yeah,
and you're in the consciousness of an obsessive character, you have to report the obsessive noticing of detail. You have no choice. So, you know, so much is dictated by character, too.
Franzi, thanks so much. It was
Thank
a pleasure
you.
Chatting.
It was a real pleasure.
The best of life they care.